David Hamilton is Chief of the Water Management Section, Water Resources Division, the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality. He oversees many of the division's engineering functions, including hydrologic studies, dam safety, lake level engineering, floodplain management, and transportation project review programs. In addition, he manages the Water Withdrawal and Water Use Program and the Great Lakes Shoreland Program, and he's one of the principal developers of Michigan's water withdrawal assessment tool, and that is what David will be speaking with us about today. So I'll turn it over to David. Thank you.
Okay, it is a pleasure to be here. I have been in Minnesota before, but usually it's because I'm driving through to the west or coming back home from the west. But I'll tell you, I always love it. Minnesota is one of my favorite places because I get really tired of the prairie. And then when I'm back in the Great Lakes and I hit that part of Minnesota where the forest begins, yes, I'm home. Now, as we've been talking with people here yesterday and today, I find there's a lot of common interest. And it's really exciting to see that. And there's common issues, as there were a group of us talking last night. And even though from different states and different programs, different angles of things, there's a lot of common issues. How we handle them, and some of the details are different. You know, the priority may be different. Like in Massachusetts, reservoirs are a really big deal because that's where your public water supply comes from. We've got maybe five communities in the state that are getting surface water from an inland water source. I mean, it's not an issue in Michigan. But one thing I've also noticed is that the way to resolve these problems is really the same. You need to involve stakeholders. It needs to be a true stakeholder process where everybody is truly at the table and empowered at the table. And you need sound science. And I think that what we've got to talk about in our experience in Michigan really reinforces that. Now, it may surprise you in Minnesota, but Michigan never regulated water withdrawals until 2006. I'll say it again. Michigan did not regulate water withdrawals until 2006. Why did we begin? One main reason, the threat of diversions. And you may remember the presidential election a few years ago. There was a candidate that came to Wisconsin. He saw Lake Michigan, said, "We could use that in New Mexico," and he wasn't joking. Although he did revise his statement later because he couldn't get too many votes in Wisconsin with that position. But there are other reasons. I mean, diversion is by far the biggest thing, and the Great Lakes are not a partisan issue in Michigan. It doesn't matter whether we have Democrats or Republicans running the state; the Great Lakes are always protect them. But there are other issues. There are places in the state where there are conflicts between water users. There are some places in the state where there's a limited amount of water that's available. So there are other reasons. Now, you may be familiar with some of this history since you're part of this history as a member of the Compact and before that the Charter. But the Great Lakes Charter started in 1985. That's when the Great Lakes governors got together and said, you know, we really need to kind of look at the Great Lakes as a unit to protect it from diversion or other things. We need to gather information and let's work together on this. And so the states did. But they also found out that it wasn't that effective, that the Charter concept wasn't really going to protect the Great Lakes from diversion. So I said, we need to do something stronger. They came up with an annex that we need to work towards this, where we are going to have programs that really will manage water, really will protect it, really look at cumulative impacts and things like that. And then in 2006, Michigan passed the first legislation to regulate water withdrawals. And then 2008, we implemented the Great Lakes Water Compact. Now, the 2006 legislation really was revolutionary. We had a standard for judging water withdrawals, and the standard was that you cannot cause an adverse resource impact, which meant that a stream's ability to support characteristic fish populations is functionally impaired. You could not cause a stream flow so that it would affect the habitat to functionally impair characteristic fish populations. That's a biological standard. Now, what does it mean? That was the problem. So the legislature said, we want to use a biological standard. We want it based on sound science. Go figure out what this means. And so we were given a year and a half to figure out what that meant. And there was a stakeholder process, and it was a wonderful group. And every major interest in water was represented at the table. So Trout Unlimited was there. Consumers Energy was there, utility. The industrial groups, utilities, environmental groups, farmers, golf course irrigators, everybody was at the table and empowered because they were given, that council was given the responsibility to develop this. And so me as a state employee and other people working for other agencies, we worked basically for that council. It was their responsibility to work something up and report it to the legislature. the philosophy that we worked under was really very good. It was based on integrating a science-based approach, wanted it to be sound science, and wanted to integrate, you know, a systems approach, integrate the science into something that really made sense. We brought in a national review panel. We brought in national experts in each of the areas of modeling impacts on fisheries, of groundwater modeling, surface water modeling, people that dealt with integrating various kinds of models. And we told them what we were planning on doing. They said, hey, this is great. It's scientifically sound. Gave us some suggestions, and we went on. They wanted to make sure it's based on data, Michigan data, not Massachusetts data, not Minnesota data, Michigan data. And that's what we did. And we established scientifically-based relationships through models using Michigan data. The science was based on a very excellent team of a number of different disciplines from the U.S. Geological Survey, DEQ, the Natural Resources Department, University of Michigan, and Michigan State University. And it really was run as an open shop. Anybody could come to any meeting that they wanted to, and it was great. The kind of the paradigm that drove it is that your big factors of climate, geology, and land use, that determines how much runoff you're going to have. That determines the volume and the timing, all that kind of stuff. And that determines your basic flow regime. Now, the local details that work out as to what exactly kind of channel is going to form there, the size of the channel, the hydraulics of the channel, what nutrients are going to be in it, what's the temperature going to be, there's more local scale there. But the bottom line is geography determines your flow regime. And your flow regime determines what kind of fish and other critters you're going to have living in that stream. It's all very much interrelated. So if we look at a hydrograph, this is another way of looking at a hydrograph. You've got your high spring flows going down into the summer where you have relatively low flows. The summer is a stressful time of the year. And we needed some measure of what are we going to measure against. And we called it an index flow, and we defined it as the median flow from the lowest summer month flow. So typically it's the August median flow. And any amount of water that we're taking out of the stream is measured against that we can take out a certain percentage of that. Again, the science drives this. So the scientific physical reality is groundwater feeds stream flow. Stream flow supports fish populations. We needed models then that could represent each of these interactions and be able to pull them together into something that would work on an interactive basis. So starting with the withdrawal model, how much water is in an aquifer? What happens when it's withdrawn? How much water is going to be taken from a stream, nearby stream, if you take water out from the groundwater? The stream flow model needed to be able to predict what is the flow in that stream anywhere in the state. And finally, the fish impact model is what fish are going to be in the stream and what impact is there going to be when you reduce the stream flow on those fish. So these models had to be developed. Three basic scientific models had to be developed and then brought together into a GIS user-friendly internet-based platform. And that was a tall order. Now with the withdrawal model, again, it makes, and this is something I think this group probably knows better than probably most, but distance matters. The further are you away from the stream, the less impact a well is going to have. The deeper it is, the less impact you're going to have. The geology matters incredibly. So with clay soils, the very tight, you have relatively little groundwater flowing through them. Sandy soils, it's the opposite. And this picture you're probably very familiar with as well. So that this concept is really difficult for some people to understand. But if you have a well, it actually intercepts groundwater that would have otherwise fed into a stream. So that's a really important concept to help people understand. Another concept that's really important is that when you have surface water runoff, that tends to be relatively warm water, especially if it's gone over impervious surfaces. The groundwater that's where you get the cold and the cool water, and that's what really is an important factor in the habitat of the streams. Now, in the withdrawal model, then we have some generalized information on the geology of the state, so we put that in, put in a well, and then it would look to see where are the nearby streams, and it would calculate the distance from streams, and it would calculate a drawdown or depletion that would affect each stream. So this would allow us to spread the drawdown to nearby streams and try to apportion what the impact is on the neighboring streams. The flow model, again, we had to be able to determine what is the index flow anywhere in the state. And the way that we do that is that we know what the index flow is at a USGS gauge. We had 147 gauges that we felt we could use in this analysis. So we used the regression analysis where we could say, okay, let's look at geology, let's look at soils, let's look at land cover, let's look at precipitation. And you can define those for the watershed that's above a gauge. You can then do a regression analysis to tell you how sensitive the index flow is to those parameters. And it can go to any other watershed in the state that doesn't have a gauge, say, this is my percent of this geology, this is my percent of forest, put it into the regression model, and it will predict what the index flow is. So that's how we handled that part of the problem. And this is the map that results. The bluer colors are very heavy base flow streams. They don't get a lot of high runoff. They don't get very low in the summer low flow months. The brownish color, these are areas where we have virtually no groundwater. These are lake bed clay areas. Groundwater is not a significant portion there. Some of these areas, you'll notice, there's big white areas. There aren't streams in these areas. These are sandy areas where there's an incredible amount of infiltration, which produces the groundwater that flows into these streams as cold water streams. They're almost 100% groundwater fed, very cold. And this is a national treasure. There's no other place in North America concentrated like this with trout streams of this caliber, this size. So that's a national treasure. If you look around the state, you'll see there's other areas with some very good stream flow characteristics, especially in the southwestern part of the state. Then the final question is, what kind of fish population lives in any given area of the state? And how do they respond to reductions in flow? And so we had to define stream types. We had to define what kind of characteristic fish go along with the different stream types. And we had to define what does functional impairment mean. And so we went to work on those questions. We developed a stream classification system. So the red is, which is based on two factors, temperature and size. So the size went stream, small river, and large river. Temperature started cold, cool, and warm. As we were doing the work, we found out there's actually a fourth category, which we called cold transitional. It's a cold water stream, but it's right on the edge. You warm it up a little bit, you take out a little bit of water, you're going to change its characteristics. It'll no longer be a cold stream, it'll become a cool stream. So we identified for every stream in the state what classification it went into. And then as far as what fish live there, we were fortunate enough to have people that looked ahead and cared about data and fisheries and hydrology. And so we had about 1,400 sites across the state where complete fish populations were mapped out. And that was critical for us to be able to do this project. Now, as a result of that, then, you could start creating a map. So this shows your base flow yield, which is your CFS per square mile, plotted against drainage area. So any stream anywhere in the state can be plotted on this chart. So you've got a drainage area, and you've got a certain amount of base flow. You're going to be at a certain location. There's an optimal location that the data points out. So like for brook trout, this is an optimal point for that fish. And this just shows a few of the fish populations. I think we looked at like 65 or so different fish species. And every one of them has its own optimal thing. And any place on a stream has a characteristic population of a combination of these different fish species. So what we could do with this information is that as you move up and down, you're holding the drainage area constant. What you're doing is you're varying the flow. And then we could do an analysis to how does that change fish population as you go up and down, as you vary the flow. And there is an impact. When you add water or take away water, it changes the characteristics of a stream. This thing could be plotted up, and you've seen this curve already in the last talk, except it wasn't quite spelled out the same way. This is a metric that has to do with the fish population, and this is a metric, and this is your proportion of flow that you're taking out. So at this point, at zero, you're not taking anything out of the stream, and at this point, you're at the initial condition of one. So this is current conditions. As you move out on the curve, you start taking out water and you start seeing some changes occurring to the fish. And there's two different curves. One is a thriving fish curve, and there's a point where there's some fish, it's kind of their optimal point. They really, really like it there. And this is like perfect home for them. And that also turned out to be a very sensitive indicator that we could pick up that, with once it started moving, that would move first, because the ones that really, really liked it, if you changed it a little bit, they'd say, well, this not as nice as what it was, and they might not quite as have many the next time, or might move on a little bit. The characteristic was not as sensitive, and this one dealt more with fish population, so you could start seeing changes in fish population. So you might see an impact on the thriving fish, but you wouldn't see as much of an impact on actual fish populations. So we had to kind of balance interpreting that. But this did give us the ability to say, okay, what is the environmental impact of taking out water? And the same curve you see, as you move down the curve, you start changing density of fish, you start affecting sensitive fish species, you start bringing in more tolerant fish species, and before you're done, you've entirely trashed this ecosystem. So this then provided us the ability to make a decision. What is an adverse resource impact? And science cannot answer that question. Science cannot answer the question of what is an adverse resource impact. That's really a social question, which comes down to a political question. So all we could do as scientists is we could say, this is the impact, and we could explain to them. But that then also set the sidebars for the politicians as to they didn't want to trash these streams, especially some of them. And so they had to wrestle with, what does this mean? What would we do? And so through the political process and with continuing stakeholder involvement, they would set a line and say, that's the adverse resource impact line. You can't go beyond it. We don't want to take this level of impact over here. Well, it doesn't make sense to just say, okay, you can do anything you want to get to that line, then all of a sudden you can't do anything more. No. That there's risk that's involved, there's some uncertainty that's involved. And so a classification system, and I was amazed at looking at Linda's in Massachusetts, because it's the same idea, the exact same idea. We just call it ABC instead of 1, 2, 3. And we drew the lines a little bit differently. So the A zone means that it's okay. You're not going to have an impact on the fishery here. You can take the water. In fact, we can automate this. If you're in the A zone, we'll give you a pass, and we'll automate it so that you can take a pass. You get into the B, and you're saying, okay, you're starting to have some impact. Maybe you ought to start thinking about conservation measures or something else. You get into the C zone, it's like you're getting really close to an adverse resource impact. You need to really get serious about that. And then for every stream type that we have, all 11, and there's 11 because there are no large cold water rivers. There were 11 categories. Every one of them then had its own unique adverse resource impact line, and each one had its own unique, this is where you need a site-specific review. So if you notice the cold transitional, this is the most sensitive. A little bit of change or a little bit of water taken out, big change in what happens to the fish. So that ended up getting extra protection. So you notice very little water can be taken out of a cold transitional. So it's like 3 or 4% of the index flow can be withdrawn from a cold transitional stream. A site-specific review is where these blue arrows show up. If you're in a cold transitional watershed, you need a site-specific review, period. Doesn't matter how much you want to take if you're part of this system. And you look at other places. So for warm, site-specific review is way down the road. And how much you can take out is way down the road as well. And in no case, the legislature said, in no case can you take more than 25% of the index flow. Okay, so as we talk about water withdrawal, if you take water, a surface water withdrawal, 100% is removed from the stream. So if you're taking 500 gallons a minute out of the stream, we just subtract it right off from the index flow. If it's a groundwater withdrawal, well, that can be less than 100% impact. It can be shared between or portioned between nearby streams, and it can be spread over a relatively large area. So we take that into account with our system. Now, what we've done is that since Michigan is such a water-rich state, we believe that it was possible to run a program that we could automate and that we could set up a tool that we would intentionally be conservative, but that it would allow people to go in the privacy of their home or their office and say, okay, I'm thinking about taking out water here at this location. Will I get a pass or not? And it will tell you, and it will give you a pass. If you're in the A zone, it will give you a pass. You push the button, and it automatically registers you. You don't have to do anything else. You don't have to visit DEQ. You don't have to fill out any separate application form. That's it. You've got your authorization. On the other hand, if it says that you're getting close, you're getting in the C zone, or this even projects that you could be in the D zone, it doesn't say no. It says DEQ. Now, for some people, that's worse than saying no. But I can tell you stories about that if you want. But anyway, it gives people an option. It gives them some information as well. They can learn about the watershed. How much could I take out without triggering I've got to go visit DEQ? And they can find that out. Now, there is a site-specific review, which is not nearly as onerous as some people think it is. We're actually friendly people. And we work very hard with people to figure out a way to yes. And that's one of the things we do in a site-specific review is we look at, okay, what information do we have about this watershed? Do we have any measurements in this watershed? What are the details of what you're doing with your withdrawal? What about your neighbors? What are they doing with their withdrawals? Is there anything that we can work out here that would get you to yes? And almost all the time, we do get people to yes. Now, some of the things I was asked for when asked to speak here is to talk about some of the things like, you know, how did we implement it? This was implemented over a period of about a year. And there was a transition time where we went from the standard that was set in 2006 to this new standard, which was based on these zones, A, B, C, and D, and these curves. We also put out a version of the tool that people could play with. It wasn't the absolute final version, but it was as close as we could get it, and we put it up online, and we invited people, you know, try it out. And, of course, everybody went to their home or their farm, and what's going to happen? And we got a lot of feedback on it, a lot of good suggestions. So we made changes to this interface that made it better and more user-friendly, and it's a much better thing because of doing that. It also created a lot of confusion because it wasn't the final version, and people did interpret it. No matter what our disclaimer said, people did interpret it as it's telling me no. So we had to work with that, but it was good. We also had the council. They were given a new assignment after the legislature passed this law. They were given a new assignment. It's like, okay, we want you to rigorously look at that. Is it really doing everything that we told you it was going to? We wanted it to do? That's what the legislature said. So the council reviewed it in detail, and we made projections, and we did analysis, and we had a real good idea of how this thing was going to work, and the council was satisfied and told the legislature that as well. There were some problems with the implementation, and I won't go into the details because it gets really confusing, but just let me say that when you're changing standards in a relatively short period of time, it means you've got some people that are in one set of standards, other people are in a different set of standards. We had different assumptions for what qualified as where you're presumed not to cause an ARI, and that was changing over a short period of time. And it's very, very confusing, and as the person responsible for administering this program, it drove me crazy. Because we'd have these six-month windows where things were changing, and trying to explain that to stakeholders, and even getting out in time to explain it to them before it changed again was maddening. But that was part of the political process of some people didn't want it starting too soon, some people didn't want it starting too late, some people wanted to reset numbers, and it just got crazy. So if you're interested in that, you're going to be administering something, I'll give you the details. Otherwise, don't worry about it, because I'm happy now we've got a set standard, and we can live with it. And the results on this, it was great. It worked exactly as predicted, very similar results to what we had anticipated. So in the first year, I can give you some results from that. 84% of the registrations that came through were agriculture. I don't know about you, but that's a pretty astounding number. And it's actually a factor of two things. One is agriculture is the biggest single user, consumer of water in the state. If you're kind of how much is consumptively used. Secondly, with the economy we've been in the last couple of years, nobody else was doing much of anything. And the farm sector has been, I've got money to invest, I'm going to put in irrigation. A lot of activity there. I think in a more normal, what I hope is a more normal economic cycle, we would expect about 60% ag, 40% everyone else, based on historic numbers. This did lead to another problem that we've got to deal with, is that the southwestern part of the state is where our agricultural irrigation is concentrated, and they're just going like crazy. They put in a lot of wells. And we've got farmers in that part of the state that are really concerned about this process, and even though we haven't told them no yet, they're concerned that day is coming. So they want to say this tool is wrong, it's blah, it's garbage. And I tell them the tool's working exactly as it's supposed to, and it's going to tell us when we're at a point where we need to look at this more closely. And since we know it's coming anyway, why don't we work together and gather some data and do a study down here and figure out what the real answers are and not rely on this little tool, but let's get information for your area and your watersheds and your aquifers and figure out how much water can be safely taken out without causing an adverse resource impact. And there's growing interest in that. I'm actually pretty confident we'll be able to do that study. So that's a problem, but there's also a solution to it. Although I won't tell you too much about this lobbyist that's running around. And Michigan has term limits, so it's like the most someone can serve in the House of Representatives is 6 years, so you're always dealing with a bunch of rookies. And we had a big turnover. And so this lobbyist who is hired by somebody to badmouth this, he doesn't like the process, is going around to all the new legislators and saying bad things about it. And the legislature was nice enough that after one of these guys had talked to a committee, they invited me to come and talk to them, so at least they listened to the other side. I was really grateful for that because they usually don't. But it's nice when they do. Another thing with this that's really astounding is that we had something over 200 large quantity withdrawals. And I don't remember if I said it or not, but you come into the system if you have a withdrawal of over 100,000 gallons per day. If you're below that, you're not in the system at all. So that's the threshold to be in this. 80% of the registrations that came through were automatically approved by through the computer system. What other governmental program do you know that issues 80% of the authorizations without ever seeing anybody or them filling out a form that they hand in or mail in or whatever? It's incredible. And it's really an achievement that we feel very proud of. And it has been recognized nationally. And so the Council of State Governments gave us an Innovations Award. The Council of State Governments is representative, or its members are governors and state legislators. So that's quite a group, and they recognize this as an innovation. The Environmental Council of States, which represents the environmental directors or commissioners or whatever your title is, be like the state-level EPA. Whoever is director of that belongs to this. And that group also gave this an Innovative State Program Award. And then finally, the Renewable Natural Resources Foundation gave us an Outstanding Achievement Award because of what this does for a renewable natural resource. And that group is made up of professional and scientific organizations. So, for example, the American Society of Civil Engineers is part of this group. The American Geophysical Union is part of this group. And so the recognition is really, really been awesome, and we've really appreciated that recognition. So, oh, I thought I had it in this talk. So to register, it's a new or increased use over 100,000 gallons per day. The requirement now is you need to demonstrate that you will not cause an adverse resource impact. And to do that, you either go through the tool, which is the online screening tool, or you have to go through a site-specific review. And you have 18 months after you register to actually install your capacity. So we have four categories, the A through Z. They're defined by legislation as to and they're different for each stream type. So the A zone, just register and proceed. Don't worry about anything else. And make sure you report your water use too. But the B zone, typically it means register and proceed. But if you're in if it's coal transitional, you're automatically in the zone and you automatically need a site-specific review. And we also need to tell some people about it, so kind of your planning level groups. We start saying, okay, your watershed is now in B, just so you know, and you might want to start thinking about it. In Zone C, a site-specific review is required. So if the screening tool says, oops, this looks like Zone C, you've got to come into the department to get a site-specific review. We can issue an authorization for this, and we do, but that user has to then certify that they're using environmentally sound and economically feasible conservation measures. And we notify a lot more people, including all the other large water users in that watershed. We notify them. The law is set up so that it tries to encourage people to work together instead of fight over water. And so it's set up these user groups with the intention of, if you're getting close to the edge, maybe these local users ought to be talking to each other and figuring out how do we stay away from the edge. Maybe we can collectively figure out some conservation measures, or maybe we can get by with less water, but encourage them to work together. Then Zone D, if the tool says Zone D, it must have a site-specific review. You cannot proceed. If we do a site-specific review and we confirm that that withdrawal would put you into the D zone, we deny it. You cannot proceed. And there is potential for preventative measures, which means you could do something that would prevent it from going into the D zone. And if we can come to an agreement on that, and an example might be taking out a dam. We're going to change both the flow and the thermal characteristics of a stream, that kind of measure would prevent someone's withdrawal from causing an adverse resource impact. So that's the best example that I can give of what one might be. The tool, you can go to online and play around with it, and I'll give you the address to it, and I encourage you to play with it, because just don't register. But it's a very user-friendly tool. There's a lot of information there. If you want to find out more background, there's papers that you can access through there. There's also pretty pictures of fish and describes the characteristics of fish populations for different types of streams and things like that. You can navigate it either by map, find a place on the map and click on it, by lat long, or by address. So it's very easy to zoom around in it. When you get into it, you can get a lot of information. So it'll show you what watershed you're in. There's 5,000 watersheds. The states divide up into 5,000 watersheds for the purposes of this. So every watershed then is assigned what stream type it is. It's assigned an index flow. And based on those two things, it'll calculate how much water is available for depletion of the stream. And again, I want to emphasize that this is based on stream flow depletion. It's not saying how many gallons you could take out of the groundwater. It's saying whatever you take out of the groundwater, what's the impact on that stream? And we've got this accounting system then that subtracts that. So you could have 10 wells and they're taking a certain amount and you add up how much they're depleting out of that stream segment. It's got information on these little red dots are domestic wells or wells that have been registered with the state. So you can go look those up. So mine's on there. I can go see my well. I can see my well log. So it provides information. It also gives someone an individual information about what other wells are, where they're located in their area, in their watershed. So it'll say, okay, in this watershed, 87% of the wells are in glacial drift. Another one might be, 60% are in bedrock. And that gives somebody that doesn't really know a lot about this, because they're going to be asked, is this a bedrock well or is it a glacial drift well? How deep are you going to put it? And those kinds of things. It'll give them some idea of what's going on with their neighbors. So if they just want to play around with it and haven't talked with a professional yet, a well driller, it'll give them some ideas as to what might make sense so they can at least do some preliminary evaluation. The results will give you information. If it gave you one where you said you have to have a site-specific review, it also gives you some suggestions. Well, why don't you move your well further away from the stream? Or why don't you make your well a little bit deeper? And so it'll give some suggestions that might help you to avoid coming to CD. Now, you may notice that I called this, what we've been talking about, as an authorization. With the stakeholders we were dealing with, it was a really big deal. They didn't want an onerous permitting program. But they did recognize at some point you did need permits. So everything that we're doing up to this point, that you go through the tool, we're authorizing you, but we don't call it a permit. I don't know the difference between the two, but it's an authorization. But we do actually get to permits at some point. If it's over 2 million gallons per day capacity, or if it's 1 million gallons per day in a C zone, then it triggers a permit process. There is an exemption of less than 2 million gallons per day use over a 90-day period, and you can drive a pretty big irrigation rig through that one. And there is a public involvement process that goes along with the permits. There are a few users that are treated a little bit differently than everyone else. And one is with municipal water supply. They can theoretically cause an adverse resource impact if they don't have a prudent and feasible alternative. Bottled water, they need a permit if they only take out 200,000 gallons a day. And that's strictly a political thing. And my last slide. This is the web address. Again, I encourage you to go look at it. There's a lot of good information. You can play with it. It's really pretty user-friendly. And since we first put it up and we got all the feedback and suggestions, we've had almost no comments on it. There were questions of what kind of problems do we have. Financial problems are severe in Michigan. Everybody's really excited when this started. So in fiscal year 2009, they gave us $900,000 in general fund to support this program. Well, we never got the money. They cut it before we ever saw it. So this past year, we've been down to $80,000 of general fund, and next year they're cutting that. And so we've got a small pot of money based on registration fees, which is about $200,000 a year, but that's not enough to run this program. So I tell anybody that'll listen to me, we're in trouble. And there are enough supporters that I'm pretty confident they'll come up with another way of supporting it. But I'll tell you right now, this is not a comfortable position to be in, trying to run this with a skeleton crew where we know we're not covering everything that we really need to, but they're doing a great job and we're getting good results. And with the first year results, we had about 5.5 FTEs running the program. We're down to 2.5 right now. And we're not getting things done as quickly as we'd like to. The legislation said that we have to get the answers out in 10 days. And we were meeting that. We're not quite meeting it as frequently as we did before for the site-specific reviews. So anyway, time for questions.
So I have two questions. Do people pay for their permit?
Two people come in for a permit. Okay.
Do they pay?
They pay? No. There is no fee to run through this registration process. The fee comes on water use reporting. So in this case, you would register, but then you have to report. When you report, there's a $200 a year fee for that, unless you're agriculture. There's no fee for that.
Of course. The other thing is, I was looking at all the information that's available. If I am the well owner, all this information is out there for anybody to look at. I mean, is there a privacy issue? Aren't people howling?
These are public documents. You can go down to the county and look them up if you want to.
Yeah, but now you can be sitting in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, and looking at this.
That's correct.
Mine's
on there.
Okay.
It's public information.
There's been a good little bit of controversy about Kennecott's proposed copper mine in the Yellow Dog River watershed. Is the Yellow Dog River in your database?
Yes. The whole state is in the database. And I was, interestingly enough, I was asked about that, and I was asked if this would cause an adverse resource impact, and the answer was no. Now, there are other issues with that, but as far as this program goes, the answer was no.
Do you have any really big groundwater remediation pump and treat systems in Zone C or D?
They're exempt from this process, so that's not an issue. I mean, there the idea is you've got to clean this up, and we're not going to get in the way with it. With this program.
Hi. I'm curious at how, right here, how did you market your program so that people would use this instead of going through a paper process?
Well, we set it up this way, and it was really, again, the stakeholders that were part of this, is what they wanted, and there was a paper process that people could opt for, but we phased that out, and people can get assistance. There are some farmers that just, this is difficult for them, but the MSU Extension will help them out. There are other people that will help them out with it. And they'll call us, and they're not to get assistance with this. A lot of people are not afraid to call us and ask questions. And there have been a few that we've actually registered for them.
I was wondering, do you have any safeguard about waste of water in this system? It's like the first one, first serve would be better off because he can be in a zone. Okay. And after a while, this A zone might shift to a B zone and to a C zone.
Right. That's an excellent question. Michigan is a riparian rights state, and the legislature made it clear that we are still a riparian rights state because people do get confused with this. This can look like it's an allocation or an appropriation of water. But what happens if you go down that path, you get into the B zone, you get into the C zone, and then someone else comes in, and we have to tell them no. They're still a riparian. They still have a right to a reasonable use of that water. And the legislature set up the users group to try to work that out. Now, let's suppose that you're coming in, you're repairing your mines, and I'm sitting there as another owner by saying, I don't like you. I'm not going to change my practices to let you in. Well, your recourse is you can sue me or the other users if they won't accommodate it. But that's also what the process is now. That's if someone doesn't have access to water because of some activity of someone else taking out too much, they have to sue. It's the courts to make the determination. So that hasn't changed. The fundamental law of water law of Michigan as a riparian rights state has not changed. What has changed is the bar has been set. So there's an environmental standard that before it was, if the stream flow went to zero or got so close to zero that you felt like you're impacted, then you would sue somebody about it. Now it's saying there's an environmental standard of flow and you can't go below that. And if you want water and somebody's not taking out too much so it affects you, you can sue them at that point. Or as the legislature set up, work through a users group to try to work it out. Okay, well, I'll be here the rest of the day, so if you have other questions during break or into this evening, I'll be glad to talk to you.